Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
All right, it's time for us to turn our attention to boxing, and I'm delighted to say on the line we have Adam Smith, who's head of Sky Boxing, to talk about the passing of Brendan Ingle. Adam, maybe this should be a celebration as much as anything of Brendan Ingle's unbelievable career in boxing in Sheffield. He left Ireland as a very young man, and so obviously he's far more closely associated with the city of Sheffield than he is with Dublin in some ways. But maybe you might put in some context for us the standing of Brendan Ingle in British boxing.
Yeah, sure. First of all, an extremely sad day over here for two reasons. Obviously, the passing of Brendan Ingle. We also lost Dean Francis at just 44, who was one of our great fighters in the earlier days of Sky. So it's been a really, really tough day for the boxing community. Brendan Ingle was a pioneer. He was a one-off. He was an extraordinary human being. I had the fortune, the pleasure of spending a great deal of time with him in the late 90s and beyond, obviously. But at that period, you know, Sheffield boxing was absolutely flying. After Harold Bomber Graham came the likes of Prince Nassim Hammad and Ryan Rhodes and Johnny Nelson and Isham Pickering and even little Dave Caldwell and all those guys. You had the likes of Herbie Hyde coming up, Clifton Mitchell and John Faxton even came from Norwich. It was a real sort of... Well, an electric place to be, Sheffield. And not just the big names as well. Kell Brook coming through. I remember him when he was 9 or 10 walking into the gym. But also the journeymen, the other people in the gym that just turned up for the camaraderie, that fought their own careers. And I remember Jason Collins, who you couldn't read or write when he came to Brendan, but Brendan made sure that he got a job. He helped him. He helped rebuild his life. And he was a Pied Piper. People followed him. People listened to him. When he started, he was controversial. You know, not everybody agreed with his style and his way, but he'd welcome everybody into the gym. And he taught what he believed was right, which was defensive wizardry and, you know, mental strength as well, you know, buoying confidence as much as footwork. And it worked so well. A lot of his fighters didn't have a mark on them when they finished their careers. And a lot of them, you know, felt he was a father to them. So, a very, very tough day for so many, and especially my great friend and colleague Johnny Nelson, who I think was the great success story of the Brendan Ingle Foundation, the Brendan Ingle Way, because Johnny wasn't any good, and he made him good in the end, and he stuck with him. And, you know, Johnny was absolutely inconsolable when he broke the news to me very early this morning. And, it's a big, big, big loss for boxing.
Adam, tell us why it was controversial in the start. Will you just explain that bit of history to us?
I mean, I think he was controversial because he did things completely differently. You know, most trainers taught a very, very different way, a fundamental textbook way, and Brendan Ingle ripped that up and did what he believed was right. You know, painted circles and lines on the Winkerbank floor. And, you know, the St. Thomas Boys and Girls Club is exactly the same pretty much today as it was, you know, decades ago. And, you know, he kept things simple. He kept it footwork. He body sparred. He didn't believe in taking great lumps to the head and sparring. He believed that, you know, that was the best way of doing it. And you didn't have to, always entertain and dazzle. You know, you had to come away with a win and with your faculties intact as much as possible. And that was his belief. And then, of course, he had fighters like Nassim Hammad who had raw power. So they were entertaining. But he didn't really mind if his fighters danced or moved around. You know, he wanted them to make other opponents look silly and, utilize their brain and their movement. And one of the things he did was he took his fighters into prisons. You know, I remember going to Lindholm in South Yorkshire and, all the prisoners having a crack at the fighters and, trying to knock them out. And they weren't allowed to hit the prisoners back. The prisoners were just allowed to hit them. And, Brendan took his boys in because he thought it would help them with reflexes, movement, and obviously, you know, raising awareness too. And you know, they were brilliant in that way. They also went around the country to every single show they could get their hands on. They traveled in packs. It was an amazing camaraderie. I remember when sort of Nassim Hammad was as at his pomp, and there was Ryan Rhodes and Thomas Bradley and Clifton Mitchell and Kevin Adamson and Johnny and Anis Awida, a load of them. And it was like, you know, they were coming to fruition, just like the Friends series in the States. And it was just like that. You know, they were inseparable. They did everything together. And whether you were as good as Naz or as sort of average as Tom Bradley was, it didn't matter. You were all part of the team. And that's what Brendan gave them. And they are... There's a lot of people that will be feeling very sad today.
What about Naz and the role that Brendan had in turning Naz into a world-class fighter? How important was it that Prince Nazim Hamed met Brendan Ingle when he was a kid?
Yeah, you know, what Brendan was brilliant at was getting kids from the streets, kids who, you know, may have been getting in trouble or could have gone down another path. There was problems in Sheffield at the time, a lot of rowdy youngsters on the streets. And, you know, Brendan didn't mind who he brought into the gym. It was every ethnic, every creed, every, you know, whether you're white, black, Asian, it didn't matter. Everybody was welcome. Everybody was treated the same. And you had to work hard. You know, that was the thing you had to do for him. Naz walked in, I think, at about 7. Ryan Rose, similarly, 6 or 7. Kel, about 9 or 10. Naz was a special talent from the early days. And what he had was an attitude on him. He had a belief, an ego, an arrogance, a cockiness that people just sort of, yeah, loved to hate, but also were fixated by him. And, you know, he was only small. He was only growing into a bantamweight at that time. And, you know, he turned pro, as a little kid. But what he learned was the flip into the ring, the dynamic movement. And he obviously possessed the power that many of the Ingle fighters didn't have. So he had the whole package. But it was down to Brendan Ingle and John, his son John, who formerly did a lot of the training. It's now Dominic, obviously, that runs the corners and has done for the last 15, 20 years. And John sort of keeps his, himself in the background as a manager and an astute matchmaker. But John did a lot of work with Naz. Brendan and John between them, and they brought in all the sort of the buzz around the story as well, and they were great salesmen too. Brendan was a fantastic storyteller, and you know they rode with it, and he was absolutely paramount to the success of Nassim Howard. And it was a terrible shame when they split, and a lot of arrows were fired from both sides, and Nick Pitt wrote that book, The Paddy and the Prince, and it was all very difficult. But I touched base with Naz this morning, and he's extremely sad. You know, he grew up with the guy, and as I said, Brendan was like a father, not only to Naz and Johnny, but to a lot of them. And, he lived across the road. You know, he never moved. He even though he got money, he got success, he never moved from across the road of the gym. He was the first person in there in the morning and the last to lock it up at night. And until the last couple of years when he's been more of ill health, and obviously the last, recent few weeks where he's been very ill. But, he loved it. He lived for it, and his legacy will never be forgotten. What he did was something I don't think anyone else has done in British boxing. And the city of Sheffield, few have done anything like what Brendan Ingle did.
Yeah, because you don't really, American boxing is full of these storied individuals who have these 50 or 60 years where they influence fighters across generations. But really, I can't think of that many other people in Britain who have the same reputation and standing over such a sustained period of time.
You're quite right. I mean, it's the length of time, which is incredible. You look into America at the likes of great late Emmanuel Stewart, who had maybe the same sort of time in training and the same success, and Freddie Roach, obviously, and especially with Freddie's Parkinson's disease, which has, hindered him a lot over the course of the time with the likes of Manny Pacquiao and so on. But I think over our side of the waters, I think Brendan Ingle, stands alone. There's been some great trainers, your likes of Jimmy Tibbs and Billy Graham, and so many now, and the Adam Booths and the Dave Caldwells who learned from Brendan. There's lots of great trainers around, but Brendan just had something different about him. There was a sparkle in his eye. There was a brilliance about him. It was a knowledge that he brought to make people's, not just make people's careers, but make people's lives, to give them a hope. And I think, he could identify talent, but he could also identify hard work and dedication. And, Johnny lost 10 of his first 13 amateur fights. He then turned professional, lost his first 3 fights. He became a British champion. He had that world title opportunity against Carlos De Leon in Sheffield. He stunk the place out. Nobody wanted to know him. He went into a self-imposed exile around the world. He failed again in a world title. But, you know, Brendan and John and the guys, they didn't stop believing in Johnny. And he spent 4 or 5 years on the road, you know, fighting heavyweights, cruiserweights, winning some, losing some, getting robbed. And when he came back, I think he was undefeated in something like 33 fights. And, you know, he found his form towards the end of his career. But I know Brendan talked to me at length about what we've done with Johnny and making him into a television personality, and the fact that, you know, that almost made him happier than any of the boxing success. The fact that Johnny Nelson has been a success from the age of 14, 15, when he walked into that gym as a shy kid who had no friends. And suddenly, you know, you look at him and he's charisma on a stick. He's got amazing personality and knowledge. He's got no ego. He's a massive success story of Brendan Ingle, because he wasn't that good. You know, Naz was brilliant. You know, Ryan Rhodes was talented. Harold Bomber, Graham Nod, had seen anything like him. You know, but Johnny was different. And I think that gives a lot of inspiration to young kids now. But Brendan, yeah, over many, many decades was inspirational. And, you know, I can't heap more praise on him. But the family will make sure the legacy lives on. John, Dominic and Alma, of course, and everybody involved with him.
Yeah, just that Johnny Nelson story. I didn't know that backstory, to be honest. And what it speaks to is somebody who cares about the person as much as somebody who cares about someone who's going to just bring a big name to the gym. And like, boxing is so full of sharks that I guess maybe that's why somebody like Brendan Ingle stands out over such a long period of time, is that it does seem like he had a genuine warmth for the people who came into his gym, whatever age they were and whatever their background and whatever their aspirations were.
That's absolutely right. You know, boys and girls, and you know, their own parents, their own families would leave them in Brendan's trust, because, you know, Brendan had a magic about him that you know, brought people together. And it didn't matter exactly what sort of level you were at, he was always going to do his best for you. And yeah, you know, when Nassim Hamad became very big and the money became an issue, because, you know, obviously you were talking millions at that point, and not just, you know, your average paydays, then, you know, things can become difficult with money. But Brendan stuck to his guns. You know, he had as much success with the, you know, the 9-10 year old kids that were starting out, or the 15-16 year old young amateurs, than he did with the world champions. It didn't matter to Brendan. We all said it was a factory, a conveyor belt on Winkerbank Hill, but it's not just a conveyor belt to bring. Like, he had 4 world champions, a ton of British champions, Commonwealth champions, European champions. It's not just about that. It's the likes of these, the young kids, the Paddy Bart, the young kid who was he was about 11, I think. And Brendan said, "Oh, he's the next star." And then there was another fella, they called him Killer, who was just a great character. And, you know, there's just so many that you sort of think now. And Daniel Teasdale, another wonderful sort of star in the gym he had. But, you know, he didn't stay with Brendan, and it didn't work out. And those that stayed loyal to him, the likes of Eugenio Witters, who was, you know, again, a real talent, but, you know, he sort of groomed him into a world champion. He gave him the confidence. And Johnny, you know, they're the ones that have stayed with him. Kell Brook, of course, for so many years. He went off to Dave Colwell, but he came back to the Ingles. And, you know, even Dave, I know, he's out in Japan at the moment with, you know, Jamie McDonnell. I'm sure that he's really feeling the pain, even the ones that sort of moved away from Brendan, because he had so much influence over all of them from such a young age. I mean, you know, even in my position as a young reporter on Sky, I was 24, 25, 26, that sort of age when, you know, I first really got to know Brendan. And I probably had, you know, a good 10 years on the road with him. And he taught me so much, you know, about the politics of boxing, about trying to keep straight, trying to become the best broadcaster in a way, because, you know, he told me the stories, and I owe a lot to him as a journalist. So, you know, he touched a lot of people in many different ways. And my cameraman, David Kane, who was always there, you know, he was on to me this morning and said, you know, I just can't believe we'll walk into that gym and not see Brendan Ingle in the corner, you know, right by the ring where he sat. And it's terribly sad. And I think because he's been around the scene for so long, it's going to be a really hard one to you know, come to terms with in the following weeks. The funeral is scheduled for Sheffield Cathedral in June, on June the 14th, and there's going to be an enormous turnout from not just the boxing community, but of course all the people in Sheffield and the surrounding areas that he touched. You know, he became an MBE for his services to Sheffield, not just to boxing. He was a real one-off, and I'm sure you've had a lot of the tributes today from various different people who are going to really miss him.
Yeah, it's funny. He didn't, despite the fact that he was so closely associated with Ring's End in Dublin, he didn't actually come back that much, or didn't kind of obviously have too many Irish fighters. It's a pity that Jason Quigley, who's there now, obviously hasn't really had the chance to work while Brendan was still there. So we haven't kind of gone over and done those pieces, and obviously he hadn't been well in recent years anyway. So, but he was over, I remember, for Ethan Pickering fighting Bernard Dunn when Bernard was a European, it might have actually been for the European title, and there was a spikiness about him. You know, he wasn't coming over just to butter up the home crowd. It was like he was there, and it wasn't the fact that he was fighting in Dublin against a Dubliner. There was none of the, it was Brendan Ingle's guy was Ethan Pickering, despite the Ireland-England rivalry, and he wasn't having any of that, I'm just here to have the crack. It was like, no, I'm coming here to win. So, I mean, I just remembered the loyalty that he showed to his own fighter. Nothing was going to break that, and he was completely impervious to any of the usual plumossing, as we would say here.
Absolutely, and he ruffled feathers. You know, he did things unconventionally. You know, he did everything he could to get that win, whether it was a journeyman or a champion. You know, he'd utilize any sort of, you know, psychology he could. And he traveled and he wanted success. As you said, he wanted success for his people. You know, I mean, look, he gave them mad nicknames. You know, there was Paddy O'Reilly and Slugger O'Toole and all of that in the gym. And, you know, he took the mickey out of everyone. It didn't matter what color you were, what green, what background you were. Everyone got, you know, got ribbed. And that was part of it. You know, he brought them all into the ring and made them sing nursery rhymes and songs and dance in front of 50, 60 of them in there. And, you know, they'd all laugh at each other. And suddenly, you know, you'd learn about, you know, the mental side of it and about, you know, gaining confidence and about, you know, standing in the middle of a ring on your own almost. And so he had really unconventional methods. But no, you're right. He took no prisoners. He wanted to win. And that was what people really respected about him. You know, a lot of people laughed at him, you know, in his ways, especially in the early days. And, you know, what is he doing with these lines and these circles? And, you know, it's not boxing. It's dancing. It's different. And, you know, he had the last laugh because he had so much success with so many different fighters over so long. And you can see what, you know, Dominic Ingle now has, you know, the likes of Billy Joe Saunders has gone up in recent times. As you said, Jason Quigley, you know, these fighters are still being lured to the Winkerbank gym because of the way, because of the fitness they get, because of the strategy, because of the heritage, and because of the fact, as I said earlier, that there's nothing really different about that gym, about the St. Thomas Boys and Girls Club. You know, the showers, the back rooms, they're all still the same. There's nothing, you know, there's a few bags from the top, and, you know, the ring at the end. You know, yeah, there may be a lick of paint over the years, but nothing has fundamentally changed from the early days. He believed in his methods. And, you know, we heard Matthew Macklin talk on Sky earlier about Brendan, and he had his first loss to a Brendan Ingle fighter in Andrew Facey, who was really awkward and really tricky, and exactly the sort of guy that, you know, your standard technically correct fighters like Matthew Macklin wouldn't want to get in the ring with early on in their career, but he did, and he lost. And you know what Brendan Ingle said to him? He said, "A loss is nothing, my friend." He said, "You'll be better for that." And Matt Macklin went and had a terrific career after that. So, you know, he knew his boxing, Brendan. And as I said, it didn't matter whether Johnny had lost his first three. You know, he said, "Don't worry, Johnny, we'll get you a win." I think he was going to give him five, actually. I think if he hadn't won in the first five, he would have he probably pushed him towards becoming a policeman, which is what Johnny's alternative was. But, you know, he got the win in fight number four. And, you know, a lot of ups and downs along the way, but the rest is history. But as I said, I think Johnny Nelson is the product. He's the pure product of St. Thomas's Boys Club and of Brendan Ingle. And, for those who don't know Johnny Nelson's story, they should learn about it quickly, because it's a massive inspiration to whatever level or talent you have. And also the fact that he can walk around now with no ego at all and the ability to speak to anyone at whatever level. That's what Brendan Ingle taught him, and Brendan Ingle was like a dad to him.
An amazing legacy for anybody to have. Adam, last question. I understand you're on your way to Kiev. You've got a golden ticket, have you?
I have indeed. I'm one of the lucky ones, I guess. I'm a big Liverpool fan, have been since I was 4 years old. Stood on the Kop for many years. absolutely love the Reds. I'm in Liverpool right now. And, I'm flying out very early from John Lennon tomorrow morning on one of the lucky flights that has stayed with us. And I think it's a sort of in-and-out job. We fly back after the game, so it's a pretty ruthless sort of 28-hour, 30-hour journey, but anything to be in Kiev. I missed Istanbul because I was getting married. I was in Athens when we lost, so I had to be there tomorrow. My two of my three kids are massive fans, but unfortunately, I could only get one ticket. So they're watching on the telly at home. I'm very lucky to be there, and let's hope we bring back the trophy.
Good stuff. Enjoy. Thanks a million for making the time for us this evening. Thanks a million.
Thanks a lot. Cheers. Bye now.
That's Adam Smith there, the head of Sky Boxing.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.